Good afternoon. So last time, we talked a bit about scheduling metrics. So we mentioned sort of the main ones we started looking at, which were throughput, sort of the time running programs and not running what we called overhead, stuff related to scheduling. Like, we need to do it, but it's not what our user cares about. They would rather get sort of the performance they get if only their program was running ideally. Turnaround time, sort of, which is kind of a proxy for like how responsive is my system to input, though it's a very particular measurement of that and maybe doesn't match sort of the things you care about as far as, you know, what programs like you care about being fast or slow, but it's measuring sort of time from when a program can run to when it finishes doing that running and sort of that collectively over all the programs. And we also mentioned briefly the idea of fairness, which came up because we learned that, oh, a lot of sort of scheduling policies we might have might inadvertently result in very bad fairness, that we'd end up, you know, not only not running something very much, but maybe essentially never running something. We talked about sort of the two simplest scheduling algorithms. So I started with first come, first serve, which is, you know, our scheduling algorithm is when we absolutely need to switch to a program, we'll take the next one on our list. And then we had a round robin where we said, well, we should probably switch between programs a little more often than that. So we'll switch to a program that's next on our list, either when we need to or when some timer expires. Mentioned that, well, how we set that sort of timer varies, and sort of if we're controlling that carefully, we'll have some time quantum we allow a program to run. You know, and if we set it longer, we'll have less context switches, less time spent finding the next program to run, and therefore we'll have better throughput. We won't have the overhead from switching to another program. We won't have the overhead from having our processor caches be running with something that, you know, wasn't previously running there. If we set it shorter, it's probably more fair that we aren't favoring one program over another, you know, in the case of first come, first serve, just because it happened to get earlier on our list for some reason, and for other, you know, reasons if we have different priorities. I mentioned that, well, you know, because we want to control that context switch overhead, sort of the typical range of time quantums you'll see operating systems choose is like between 1 and 100 milliseconds, and sort of the idea is that we know that there's this cost to context switching that's kind of on the order of like a tenth to a hundredth of a millisecond. You know, and most of that cost is based on sort of caches not being warmed up. That when we start running a program, just switching to it, the caches have stuff for the previous program. And it's gonna take a bit of time for them to load all the stuff for the current program. And that also means that that cost of context switching actually varies a lot and is not that easy to measure. Then we talked about, okay, we want to optimize turnaround time, and we mentioned sort of our simple idea was that it turns out when you run shorter things first, that's what optimizes turnaround time. And that, you know, the sort of the schedule we think of for that, if everything starts at the same time, is that we just, you know, sort them by length and run the shortest one first. But that doesn't actually solve our sort of general case where things like become runnable at all sorts of times. And we'll look at that later today, sort of how we take our this observation that running the shorter things first is what we want to do and make it work when we have things, you know, become runnable at any old time. Then we looked at, related to this idea that, oh, we're going to prioritize things, at priority scheduling, sort of a different sort of scheduling goal where sort of our system administrator has some notion of these programs are important and these programs aren't. And we mentioned that this is where we solve the problem of starvation, that, you know, we can have, just by accident, we'll have very, very bad fairness. And, you know, you might say, okay, well, if I'm prioritizing like interactive programs over that long-running compile, maybe I don't care if that compile is slow, but I might start caring if that compile is, you know, takes a day instead of a minute. and we can really actually accidentally build those sorts of scenarios with priority sketching. And then we started talking about a different way of thinking about scheduling policies where we say, you know, some program is more important than the other, which was this proportional share idea, that rather than starting with we're going to sort things in some order, which is basically what priority scheduling does, we started with we're going to do the fairest thing, which is choose randomly between things, and we'll weight that by importance. This gave us proportional share scheduling, including the lottery scheduling algorithm that we're going to have you implement in the next assignment, and what I'll talk about next. Before I move on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so don't see any questions. Okay, so we'll move on to looking at lottery scheduling. So I mentioned that sort of our goal with this proportional share scheduling was that we're going to start with fairness and we're going to say, oh, you know, if something is twice as important, I don't want it to run, you know, infinity times more often. I want it to run like twice as often. And lottery scheduling gives us a mechanism to do that. Yes? So can you go over the first question from the quiz? Okay. So that will be a little diversion from, that's definitely not a lottery scheduling thing, but let's look over that. So the first question on the quiz was about pipes, which we covered last Tuesday. And the problem here is we want to send the output of program A as the input to program B. So if we were just doing that, we make a pipe, one pipe, and we'd make its right end be program A standard out, and its read end be program B standard in. But there's this but here, but we want to convert all the output to uppercase as we're doing this. So the strategy that this code, sort of code outline is doing, is that we're essentially doing program A into some filtering code that converts things, that reads something as that might be lowercase and converts it to uppercase into program B. Because we need some code to do that conversion. That's how we're doing it, and the code to do that filtering is here. We have a read, we say something uppercase, and then we do a write. So to make this work, we want it to be the case that we're reading from program A and writing to program B. So to figure out how to do that, well, we need to, when program A runs, we know it's going to be outputting to the right end of pipefd's 1. So we need to read from the read end of pipefd's 1. And this means that if we want program B to be able to get some independent pipe, it better use pipefd's 2. Because if it uses pipefd's 1, then how do we know whether program B should read or this code here should read? We wouldn't have a way to tell, so we want separate pipes to distinguish that. And that means that here we're going to write to the right end of pipefd's 2, and we're going to need a dupe 2 here to set program B's standard in to the read end of pipefd's 2. Questions? Yes?
Why do we need two pipes?
So we're doing this strategy here where we're having the filtering code run in between the two programs. The only way we can do that is by not having the programs directly output between each other. So the first, so each program needs a separate place to go and, you know, to get input from or put input into. And that's why we want one pipe for each program to do that. If we just had one pipe, we just had one pipe total, then we'd have no way of like saying, you know, are we writing to program B or to the filtering code? The way we make that distinction is by having separate file descriptors for each case. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes?
Can you go over the very last question?
Can I go over the very last question on the quiz? Sure. So, so this last question is asking about making particular scheduling changes. So here we're saying we run thread B from time 0 to 3 instead of 1 to 4. And run through A in that time. So what we're doing here, if we think of that, is that previously we would run thread B in times 3 to 4, and now we're running it in times 0 to 1, And instead of running thread A in time 0 to 1, we're running it in time 3 to 4. So thread A, if we think of its turnaround time, well, it became runnable up here, or possibly earlier, and finished being possible to run here. So nothing changed there. But program B will finish one unit earlier. So that's why it's saved. And we do the same analysis for each of these scenarios. And in some cases, you find that we only save time. In some cases, we find that one thread lost some turnaround time and one thread gained some. You have to do the calculation to see whether that works out as an overall gain in total turnaround time. Which is the sort of, we've chosen by using total turnaround time to have a particular way of weighting all the threads, quote unquote, evenly, which maybe you wouldn't actually want to do, but that's what the decision this question is making. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So that was on our scheduling topic, and back to lottery schedules. So I mentioned we're going to do this proportional share idea. So let's say I decide that program B is twice as important as program A and twice as important as program C. So what I might do with this lottery scheduling idea is that I'm going to assign each program a number of tickets. And every time we need to decide what program to run next, I'm going to run a lottery with these tickets as lottery tickets. So let's say we give each ticket a number. That means I'm going to choose a number from 0 to 400. And some, the range 0 to 100 is A. The range 100 to 300 is B. The range 300 to 400 is C. So I choose that random number. I look at who has the ticket for that number. And that's who I run next. And this sort of idea of running these lotteries lets us implement this policy where we can adjust how relatively important B is to everything else. So in this case, I've chosen that B is twice as important as A and C, or alternately, if you look at it as, B is as important as A and C together. And that means that B gets to run as often as A and C get to run together, given how this lottery works. It's sort of in probability. Obviously, in practice, there's going to be some random variation. And because we can set these numbers of tickets, we can use this proportional share idea to simulate a lot of other policies. So earlier we talked about strict priority, which is very flexible, because we could set those priorities in all sorts of ways. In fact, we'll look at some example later today of setting those priorities for turnaround time reasons. But let's say, what we really want is turnaround time, or not turnaround time, what we really want is priority scheduling, but we have this mechanism here. We have these ticket assignments. Well, we can assign the tickets, and these big ratios to simulate priority. So here I've said that, A is the most important, so it gets 1,000,000 tickets. B is second most important, it gets 1,000 tickets. And C is the least important, so it gets 1. And this is very close to strict priority, where A is highest priority, B is second highest, and C is lowest. And I can sort of adjust how close it is to strict priority by adjusting the ratio. So here I said, higher priority runs 1,000 times more. I could make that 10,000 instead. Or I could make that lower. I could make that like 10 times more and get it further away from strict priority and closer to something fair, more round robin. And that's kind of the attraction of this proportional share idea, is that by adjusting these numbers, I can do a lot of policies with this one sort of implementation. I just need a way of setting these ticket numbers. So questions on our lottery scheduling idea? Yes?
How do we allocate?
Question, how do we allocate more tickets and keep the relative priorities the same as more processes get added? So if we just want all processes to have the same priority, then we could just say every process gets 100 tickets. If we want to do something like have two users have the same priority and they're running multiple processes, we need to do something like You know, when the user starts a new process, like we redivide the tickets among their processes. That answer your question? Yes. So when we're scheduling, we... Yeah, so every time we do a schedule, we do this lottery. We do this random choice. And we'll pick one ticket based on that, and whoever is assigned that ticket is the one we'll run. Other questions? Yes. Question, do I not have to every time I process that I reallocate all the tickets? So we're going to gloss over some details of doing this operation efficiently. So I expect in the assignment, you're going to all implement this in some way, which is linear time with the number of processes. Please don't make it, you know, time proportional to the number of tickets, but proportional to the number of processes is likely. There are ways of maintaining data structures that allow you to do quick updates. That's less bad. We're not going to have you worry about them because this is not a, you know, a data structures class about you know, trees for doing range comparisons. Yes. So question, when a process is finished, are its tickets removed? So when a process isn't runnable, it doesn't participate in the lottery. So this lottery here assumes that A, B, and C are the set of runnable threads. So if C wasn't runnable, we shouldn't have 300 to 400 in the lottery. If A isn't runnable, we shouldn't have 0 to 100 in the lottery. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes. How do we determine what the actual priority is? So if we're simulating priority, we never actually get actual strict priority. We're getting an approximation of it because it's not strict priority because in the schedule, B can run if A is runnable, which would be impossible with strict priority. Question, how do commercial laptops determine priority? There are a variety of scheduling algorithms that are in use in practice. We will talk about later, briefly, give a very high level overview of the default one on Linux. But there are lots of different choices you can make. Some of them could be assigning, you know, using this proportional share algorithm, having some way of assigning tickets that you sort of matches, you know, things I want to be responsive or something like that. Turns out that this proportional share algorithm isn't used very much, and we'll talk about why. Other questions? Okay, so in the assignment, you're gonna add lottery scheduling to XV6, which means we need to set the tickets. The way we're gonna have you do it is we're gonna have a system call to set the number of tickets of the current process. Also, because we want to actually test your scheduler, you need to add a way of counting how often threads are scheduled. Because otherwise, how could you possibly know it works? And as I mentioned, we're fine with you doing these decisions in linear time, even though, yes, the good implementations of this do something that isn't linear time, which is complicated, involves maintaining some fancy data structure so you can quickly, you know, update your that set of lottery ticket numbers when a process enters or leaves. We're not going to worry about that. Also, yeah, something you might want to do in a more sophisticated version of this is if I'm thinking about simulating priority, we might want to do something that if A becomes runnable while B is running, we might want to make another random decision to account for, you know, A should have had a chance to get run. We're not going to worry about that. We're only going to make these decisions when XV6 normally would. We're not going to add any preemption, even in the case where something that has a huge number of tickets comes along, you know, and becomes runnable in the middle of something with very few tickets. And this algorithm, so I've kind of given a good impression of it, but there's lots of reasons not to like it. And this was proposed by academics in 1994. And they had a lot of extra details we're not going to talk about worked out, like how to deal with preemption. So how to deal with what if that big process with tons of tickets becomes runnable, while having very few tickets is runnable. How to sort of compensate for programs that can't use their full time slice. And how to do scheduling for things like disk I.O. with the same type of idea. And it's a nice thing for academics because it has this nice property of supporting a wide variety of policies. Because as I mentioned, you can simulate priority, you can simulate lots of different things by just tweaking the number of tickets, and you can do it in a way where setting priorities wouldn't quite achieve that kind of goal. But there's some issues. Let's start with one. So let's say I'm doing lottery scheduling. I have two threads, thread A and thread B. Thread A has one ticket, thread B has 9 tickets. So over 10 time quantum, what we would like is that thread A runs for one out of 10 times. We have 10 total tickets, thread A has one of those 10 tickets, should run about one time out of 10. So my question is, what is the approximate probability that A runs for at least 3 time units out of 10? Which is 3 times as much as it's supposed to. And I'm not looking for an exact answer, just rough number. Okay, so who would like some more time? Okay, who can give me some approximate number? Yes. So you got 5.7% for exactly 3, equals 3, not greater than. So how did you get that? Okay, so you're estimating 6 or 7%. How did you do the exact calculation? What was the sort of...
I kind of love 10 to the third times 9 tenths
to the 7. Okay, so you're saying, okay, so we need to have 1 tenth to the third times 9 tenths to the 7th. So this is the probability we have 3 times when we make this 1 out of 10 choice. 1 out of 10 choice, and 7 times when we make this 9 out of 10 choice, and then you did times... Then you just times 3 choose 10 to the number of ways to do to choose 3 things, choose 3 times for it to run. So this is indeed the correct calculation, which I don't expect you all to know because probability is not a prereq for this class, for computing exactly 3. And if you figure out what it is for 3 or more, you get around 7%, which is, it's not that high, but it's probably actually a big practical problem that 7% of the time over some, noticeable period of time, running something 3 times as often as it should run. That's not very consistent. And that's sort of what lottery scheduling does. And I did the brute force method. I wrote a little Python program and simulated it because, I assumed that when I did the binomial distribution calculations, I made a mistake. Just double check. And another thing you'll notice is that, it doesn't run at all like a third of the time in that 10 units. Also not very good. It's not starvation. It's still going to run, but it's not very consistent. So that's sort of a big sort of turn off to actually deploying this lottery scheduling algorithm in practice. Is that it is random. And those random decisions, they work out over the long term, but over short periods, like hundreds of milliseconds, which is something that you could notice, right? That's a tenth of a second, that's like mouse click sort of thing, they maybe don't work out so well. Just sometimes. So there is a variation that these same authors came up with later called stride scheduling, which is a deterministic variation of lottery scheduling. So it basically, it does the same ratios, but in a deterministic way. We're not gonna talk about how to implement that because there's a lot more bookkeeping. Like, it loses the elegance of lottery scheduling, which is that not only is it flexible, but there's not a lot of bookkeeping to do. But if you make this deterministic, you've got a lot of bookkeeping. Yeah.
This is maybe sort of off base. But why don't we just do this somewhere instead of keeping track of numbers of lottery tickets, we just adjust the time quanta based on priority. So we give higher priority items longer periods.
So the question is why don't we do a system where we give higher priority things longer time quanta to do this ratio thing? So I think that probably is viable for achieving the sort of total time over time for things that are always running. So like in this scenario, it would achieve the same sort of long-term goals. There are problems with adjusting the time quanta. So one is that if you set the time quanta too short, your throughput just goes way down, and you might want to avoid that. Another is that a lot of programs in practice, can't actually run for that long. Like when they run, it's because of a mouse click or something like that. So giving them a longer time quanta won't actually increase how much they get to run. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes. So the question is, can we just increase the number of tickets for processes that need active users? Absolutely. And we'll talk about that sort of scheme. We'll talk about that next. So we can do priority or tickets. So this lottery scheduling and this priority scheduling, I talked about them both because they're ways we can implement lots of policies. We set a number of tickets or we set a priority, like an old policy, and we're going to go back to what about implementing our minimized turnaround time policy. And indeed, for that policy, we basically want to give high priority or high number of tickets to the things that are interactive, which are going to have short CPU bursts. And we mentioned earlier on that the policy we want is what I call shortest job first. And we can think of that in terms of priority scheduling as the CPU burst length determines priority. Shorter burst, higher priority. But we need to think of how preemption works with this, and we'll get to that in a bit. And the preview is that we're going to need to worry about remaining time, and I'll show why later, that I can't just do CPU burst. But I have this algorithm here, and let's say I wanted to implement it. So I can write a priority scheduler, or I can simulate it with my library scheduler. But I have a problem, which is I need to set my priorities as the CPU burst length. And in my examples, we've shown you, well, the CPU burst is this many units. In practice, we don't generally know that. When you write a program, you don't like write, do 5 units of CPU. You write a loop. And the OS has no way of knowing, you know, what that loop's going to do. So, you know, we're going to need some way of solving this problem. We'll get to that later. But let's assume we do know. And let's look at why sort of the most obvious mechanism for this without preemption has problems. So preemption, remember, is like if something gets interrupted, we run something else in its place immediately. You know, we interrupt it rather than waiting for it to give up the processor. So I'm going to have an example here I'm going to use a couple times where I have 3 programs which have this regular pattern of alternating between a CPU burst and I/O. And if we think of our shortest job first schedule, what we want to do, it seems, is we want to run program B at the highest priority. It's the shortest, followed by program C, followed by program A. So it seems like, oh, if we want to minimize turnaround time, if I know our programs look like this, I just need to set program B to the highest priority, program C to the second highest priority, program A to the third highest priority, and that'll do it. And if we do that, we'll find out that it doesn't actually work out all the time. And there's this corner case we need to worry about. And sort of here I've shown an example of how that schedule looks. So I've assigned those priorities, so I run program B. And program B finishes, it's going to wait for its I/O, which will finish here. Then program C runs. It's going to wait for I/O, which will finish here. Then program A runs. And while program A is running, not surprisingly, program B's I/O finishes, and program B is ready to run. And in this case, well, that's not so bad. Maybe we should just keep writing program A. But this second time, after program C runs the second time, its I/O finishes right as program A starts running. And we just let it wait until program A finishes. So we need to do some sort of preemption. So if we don't do preemption, this is not going to really work out. We really need to have some mechanism to say, even though you could keep running, I need to run this other thing. We need to have that strict priority notion. So we need to do preemption. Now, preemption, so seems relatively straightforward. You know, that just means that we're going to run, you know, B in here, like directly. But there's a problem here. You know, preemption solves the problem where we had a long job running, a short job interrupts it. But what if a long job is almost done running and it's interrupted? If we just do the strict priority thing, we're going to let the thing that interrupts it keep running. And that's not what we want to do. So rather than have our priority be based on the CPU burst length, we're going to have it change. It's going to have to be based on the remaining time. And I'll show you an example of like where this would really matter. So going with this example here, you know, normally, you know, here, B should run right away rather than A because B can finish faster. But here, C can run in this little slice of time. But if we run C, rather than running A, we're going to slow things down. We're going to increase the turnaround time because A can finish so quickly. So even though A has these long CPU bursts, when it's almost done, we want to make sure that it has higher priority. So we need to adjust these priorities dynamically based on the remaining time in the CPU burst. We can't just set them statically. At least we can't set them statically and achieve that minimizing turnaround time because of cases like this, where something would interrupt our normally low priority thing right before it's done, and that would be a really big cost. And so this gives us our sort of actual optimal schedule, which is known as shortest remaining time first. And this is how we minimize turnaround time. Yes. The space between C here. So the what's going on in the space where nothing can run? So in both of the examples, in both this and the non-preemptive example, we have some cases where every single program is waiting for IO. And in that case, there's nothing we can run. Does that answer your question? Yes. Other questions? Yeah. Question, the arrow indicates when the program starts waiting for IO and finishes. So the length of the arrow, so this IO period here is represented by this arrow down here. Does that answer your question? Yes. So the question is, what things cause schedule switches here? So to implement this policy, we only run something else when something becomes runnable or finishes. So we don't need timer interrupts, actually. We just need whenever the IO finishes. So whenever the IO finishes, we evaluate whether we want to run something immediately or we want to wait for the current thing to finish up what it's doing. Other questions? So we have this shortest remaining time first policy. So to deal with that case where something becomes runnable right before we finish, we need to adjust our priorities based on the remaining time to handle that almost finished situation. And this policy here, if we have preemption, minimizes turnaround time, assuming we ignore context switch costs and we only allow one core. And if we don't allow preemption, the policy where we just did the static priorities minimizes turnaround time, assuming we don't allow leaving the processor deliberately idle. Why would we leave the processor deliberately idle? Because if we're being omniscient, we can say, oh, I could run A, but C's about to finish. But assuming we don't do anything like that, if A can run, it's the only thing we can run, we run A, then the static priority approach is the best we can do if we don't preempt. If when IO finishes, we don't switch to something else. Some questions? Results, and I'm mentioning these are results which have mathematical proofs, which we're obviously not going to go over. I just want you to be familiar with them. Yes? So the question, this has been proven to be optimal? Yeah, this is proven to be optimal under some assumptions, like no context switch cost, one core, and things like that. But there's the problem, of course, as you mentioned earlier, that it kind of relies on us measuring the remaining time or the CPU burst length, and we don't actually know that in practice. Right? In math, you can have your proof assume that it's known, but here we can't do that. And just an aside on names, I'm going to use SRTF to always refer to the preemptive algorithm and SJF to refer to the non-preemptive algorithm, but you might see some textbooks and the like use SJF to refer to both of these. I'm sorry, it's confusing. Okay, yes. Question, why here would it make a difference?
Yeah.
Because if we ran B here, then A will finish over here, which will increase its turnaround time at the cost of very slightly decreasing C. It will increase its turnaround time a lot at the cost of very slightly decreasing C's turnaround time. B and A, can I interchange B and A? We have lots of times where B and A are used. Where do we meet?
Third from the right and second from the right.
Third from the right. 1, 2, 3. Here?
No, on the left.
Here?
Yeah.
So why can't we run? So here we have to run A because it's the only thing that we can run. And here, B needs slightly less time than A does, so B has the least remaining time, so we must run B to minimize turnaround time. If we run A instead, then we're going to decrease A's turnaround time by less than we would increase B's turnaround time if we ran it later. Does that answer your question? Yes. Couldn't we incorporate context switch cost by sort of adjusting the remaining time? So you can attempt to do that. I mean, some problems with that are that context switch cost is variable. And this depends on what happens in the future in some inconvenient ways. Like, because if something else interrupts you, do you want to, you know, that could affect how many context switches you do in a way you might not predict right away. So, like, I agree as a general heuristic that probably works out fine, but as far as proving things, you know, it's hard to come up with, I think, a clean way of writing down those assumptions and coming up with a proof that people will care about. Does that answer your question? I don't think you can make an elegant way of modeling context switches that would make people happy with that the proof is useful, right? But this sort of this is definitely a simplification, which is why people like it as a proof. But if you try to model context switches, people probably would just not be very satisfied. And I guess the other part of it is that usually our time quanta are large enough that the context switch cost is like on the order of 1 to 10%, so it's not a huge deal. And I guess people don't care much about the details of this because, well, we can't really know the CPU burst lengths. Right? If we can't actually implement this algorithm, do we really want to go to more effort to prove some optimal variant of it? Of another thing we also can't implement. Other questions? We talked about CPU burst length. So, mentioned we have this nice algorithm that we can't do because we need to know how long CPU bursts are, and we need to know that remaining time, and we can't in practice. So sometimes you can ask. So in some batch scheduling systems, for example, you know, you'll submit your weather simulation and you'll say it's going to run for 2 hours. That doesn't really work in the sort of interactive CPU scheduling point of view. And, you know, we could say, well, how are we going to figure it out? And, you know, we could say, is it in the thread control block? And, well, if we look at X36, none of these really tell us anything about how long the CPU burst is. Right, we don't have that information, so we're going to have to do something extra to collect that information. It's not here. There's not even like sort of an approximation of it here. Like we can't like look at the size of the process, you know, how much memory is allocated. That doesn't give us a good estimate. We can't, you know, look at the open files. That's probably not going to give us a great estimate. Maybe we could like guess something from there based on what files it has open. But you know, we have only best really crude ideas about does this process have long or short CPU bursts from all the information in our process control block. So we're going to want to collect some new information to guess that amount of time. And we want to do it without actually running the program. And there's a key observation that operating systems have made to actually estimate the CPU burst length, and that's that programs typically behave in a self-similar way, that most programs, if you see them having CPU burst of a couple milliseconds now, that's likely to be true, you know, 10 seconds from now, or 100 seconds from now. Because, like, if we think of our web browser, you know, it's typically responding to mouse clicks or network events, it's likely to continue doing that. If we think of our compiler, it's doing lots of processing, likely to continue doing that. So what we can do is we can look at what happens at earlier on in the program to schedule it better later on, to do something that approximates SRTF, where we estimate the remaining time based on what was remaining the previous time it ran. And so there are lots of ways we can apply this observation that the past CPU bursts are like the future ones. I'm going to show one algorithm that is the basis of some real schedulers. That's a particularly simple way of figuring out this remaining time idea in a way that is relatively simple and sort of ties nicely to priority scheduling the way we want to do it to minimize, you know, turnaround time. And this notion is something called a multi-level feedback queue. And we're going to combine sort of the time estimate update with the priority update. And rather than like storing an explicit time estimate, which we could absolutely do, we're going to have our priority of our program represent our current estimate on how long its CPU bursts are. So if it becomes runnable, how long will it need? That's going to be estimated by its current priority. And we're going to have a finite number of priorities, so basically we're going to have our estimates in buckets. And that's fine because, you know, we're not going to get exact numbers anyways. This is all heuristics. I'm going to show one version of this scheme. There's lots of variations you can make. So I'm going to make some choices that are arbitrary just because I need to make choices. But the key idea is that we're going to set priorities for programs, and we're going to adjust those priorities so the priority is an estimate of its CPU burst length. And we're going to have, therefore, programs with shorter CPU bursts have higher priorities. So what I might do is I might say, OK, I'm going to have four priorities. And programs with a 0 to 1 millisecond CPU burst length are going to run at priority 3. Programs with 1 to 10-ish are going to run at priority 2, and so on. Like, that's sort of my overall goal. And I'm going to place them at priority levels based on that. Now, I can't do that exactly, but this observation that this is what I want to do is going to let me think about, you know, how I'm going to run these programs. That if I assume the programs that are priority 3 have like this 0 to 1 millisecond CPU burst length, then they should only need to run for a millisecond. If they run for more than a millisecond, I know something's wrong, that I made a wrong guess, that they don't actually belong here. They aren't actually in the 0 to 1 millisecond range. I probably should label this diagram. This is the burst time, not the quantum in this diagram. So if you use more than a millisecond at priority 3, something's wrong with my estimate. You shouldn't be at priority 3 because you aren't in that 0 to 1 millisecond CPU burst bucket. Similarly, if you use only a millisecond and you're at priority 0, thread D runs for a millisecond, something's wrong because I estimated that it's going to need more than 20 milliseconds for its CPU burst. So I should move it to some other bucket. So this gives this simple algorithm. We're going to set, for each priority level, a different time quantum. So we're going to enforce that things at priority 3 run for 1 millisecond and no longer. Things at priority 2 run for 10 milliseconds and no longer. And I've just chosen these numbers arbitrarily. We can make, you know, lots of different choices, but we just need to have this sort of a notion that higher priorities run for shorter amounts of time. And we'll do something like round robin. We could do something maybe more sophisticated, but round robin's the simplest thing, with a different quantum at each priority level. And every time we're going to run the highest priority thing, so in this case, this is thread A, and let's say thread A runs for 10 milliseconds and it still needs to run. Well, in that case, we're going to say, well, I was wrong about thread A. It's not a thing that's in the priority 2 time bucket, so I'm going to move it to a lower priority. So I'll move it down to priority 1. So the action will be I'll add it to that priority queue. It's still runnable. That's fine. We'll run it sometime later. And now we'll switch to thread B, which we thought still is, you know, lower on the lower end of remaining time, and run it instead of continuing to run thread A, which is taking too long to, you know, be fairly where it was. Let's say thread A doesn't use its whole time slice. In that case, we'll speculate that maybe it really belongs at the next priority level and move it up. And if that's not true, later on when we try to run it the next time, we'll move it back down. I said I made a choice here that I'm going to move it back up. You can imagine where cases where we like keep it at the same level, if it's in some time range or something like that. Just to keep things simple, I'm doing this after something runs. You know, if it finishes in time, we move it up. If it doesn't finish in time, we move it down. Just to have this, you know, only two possibilities. And yeah, if we were more sophisticated, we could have some middle choice where we keep it at the same priority level. But the overall goal here is that things are shifting up in priority if there's evidence that they have a shorter CPU burst, and down in priority if there's evidence they have a longer CPU burst. So we end up sort of overall with things generally being at a priority level that corresponds to their CPU burst length. So we do something like that static priority notion I talked about earlier, where, you know, we run, you know, in our early example, the C with the short CPU burst at the highest priority, and so on. Yes?
Is this a method on its own, or is it a patch to the shortest remaining time first?
So is this a method on its own, or is it a patch to the shortest remaining time first? So we can't actually implement shortest remaining time first, because we would need a way of measuring remaining time. So this is a method that happens to approximate shortest remaining time, because we can't actually do shortest remaining time, but because we can't measure remaining time, but we can measure whether something uses a whole time quantum or not. That's easy to measure. And kind of measure it by accident even, because, well, timer interrupt happens, we know, nope, it yes, it used the whole time quantum. Or timer interrupt doesn't happen, no, it didn't. Yes? So the question is, what do we do for a new program? So we have a bunch of choices. We could put it at any priority level. I have an argument for any particular place to put a new program. When new thread starts, where should we put it? Any proposals? Or any proposals about where we shouldn't put it? Or shouldn't we put a new program? Yes. Yeah, so you have a proposal that put it at the highest priority. Maybe we're wrong, but if we're wrong, we'll find out right away. And that's typically the strategy operating systems use with this, is that when we don't know, we just put it at the highest priority, we'll run it for a little bit of time, and we'll quickly find out, oh, its CPU burst is really long, and lower its priority, you know, at a slight cost of not running some other things right away. But not that much lighter, because, well, you know, if there's something else at priority 3, it'll run a millisecond later. So that's our cost, is about a millisecond. Yes?
I have two questions. First, the estimated burst for each priority, corresponds to the quantum you actually assign to it?
Question is, the estimated burst correspond to the quantum you sign up for? It's related. It's not exactly the same. Because something which needs, you know, 5 milliseconds in this idea is going to oscillate between 3 and 2.
And also, does this avoid starvation, or do we still have that problem?
Question, does this avoid starvation? It does not. If we care about starvation, we need to do something else. So we end up with a scheme where we, you know, higher priority means we are shorter time quantum. You know, and basically threads end up sort of oscillating around the right priority based on their CPU burst length if it's consistent. If it's not consistent, they'll move around more, but they'll still be sort of in the right neighborhood based on how long they use the CPU when they can run. Yes?
If the program runs only for 3 milliseconds, but you put it on the lowest priority, wouldn't you know it that it's fast right away after it finishes?
So the question is, here I'm putting things on the next higher priority. Couldn't I like jump up more? Absolutely. I'm just keeping this as simple as possible.
So like we were talking about defaulting to the highest priority because you know right away, but then you still know right away if you're defaulting to the lowest priority and for one finishes.
Question, wouldn't I still know right away, you know, if the time length is wrong and it's all to the lowest priority? The problem is starvation. That we are not going to run things in the lowest priority for quite a while, so it will be much longer until we know that it probably should be at a higher priority. Yes, we will find out eventually, but that eventually could be very long from now. Yes?
So in this example here, it doesn't appear as if it's actually possible for a thread to settle at like a certain priority. Like,
so question, in this example, a thread can't settle at its own priority? Yes, so what in this scheme, what happens is it oscillates at the right priority. So we could imagine a scheme that avoids that, if we cared, by not always going up to the next priority using some metric based on like measuring that how much of the time quantum you didn't use or something like that. Does that answer your question? Okay, I just chose the simplest possible scheme, which is going to not settle quite as elegantly. Other questions? So let's look at an example of how this might work. So here I have two programs. I have A with this CPU burst alternating with IO, and B with these long CPU bursts. And what happens is we start B at the highest priority. Let's say B finishes in IO. B starts running for the time quanta at priority 3. Then after B uses that, B can still run, but it moves down to priority 2. So B's ready, but A is running instead of it. And A runs, and it doesn't use its whole time quantum, so it stays at priority 3. Then A does some I.O., and B runs in that. Then A does some I.O., and B runs in that. And then B has in total, this time here, used the whole time quantum at priority 2. So you can see that there's a little ugly bookkeeping here to deal with. Oh, how much did you actually use that whole set of time? So we demote it to priority 1. Which has a much longer time quantum. And again, B keeps running in the gaps of program A, which is at the highest priority. And then B finishes. It doesn't use its whole time quantum at priority 1, so it goes up to priority 2. So we see they start at the highest priority. We made the wrong guess for where B should be. That's fine, because we'll correct it quickly. So B is demoted, and then B does this sort of oscillating pattern. Yes? The question, why doesn't A run all the time? Question, why doesn't A go to priority 2? Because A, the amount of time A is used each time it's runnable is less than the time quantum. So A used this much time, the time quantum at priority 3 is longer than that. So if we're going back to our example here, it would be like if A used half a millisecond. You know, it's less than that time quantum, there's no reason to demote it. Yes? So isn't the total time A runs at priority 3 greater than the time quantum? Yes, but there's I.O. in between, and that resets the time quantum. And the same is going to be true for B here. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
How did B get promoted back when you start coming from the beginning of?
Why did B get promoted back here? Because when we looked at, so B, at this point, finished using its time quantum. It's doing I.O. And we looked at, did it use the whole amount of time we allocated for it at priority 1? The answer was absolutely not. So it must be go to, so you send it up to priority 2.
But then it's still longer than quantum of 2.
But it's still longer than quantum of 2? Yes, which is why we're going to have this oscillating behavior. It's going to go up and down and back down again. Does that answer your question? Okay. We could imagine a scheme which adjusts things so it stays somewhere, but that involves a more complicated issue. Other questions? Yes. Why is it small? Question, why is B take run less time at priority 1 than priority 2? Because it just is how much time was left over in B's CPU burst. When it switched down to priority 1 was less. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Would it be like timer interrupt the process and drop down to the next priority? Do we not keep track of how long it's been for in the last priority level?
Question, when we drop a process down, do we not keep track how long it lasts for the last priority? Not in this scheme, but that's absolutely, possibly a pretty good addition. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Has a time longer than the shortest quantum, it will always oscillate between two priorities?
Question, if a program has a time longer than the shortest quantum, it will oscillate two priorities? Yes, in this scheme. So there are variants of multi-level feedback queues which have a more sophisticated switching priorities algorithm, which will avoid this, but I've shown you the simplest possible scheme where we don't have that. So then I don't have to describe what are the conditions for staying at the same priority. I just avoided that by saying we always move up or down. Does that answer your question? Yes, okay. Question, when B is ready, is that also part of its quantum? No. So we don't want to do that because things at priority 3, there could be quite a lot of them, and we don't want to charge B for their time. And that is a little bookkeeping nit we need to do, is we need to keep track of how much time remains in the quantum when we switch away from priority 2. Yes?
Would a timer interrupt happen in according to the priority 3 quantum?
Question, when are the timer interrupts happening? So what would have happened is that, you know, we would have set here a timer interrupt to go off after the time quantum. We would have canceled that timer interrupt here, set one that go after A's time quantum. Then when we started running B again, we set another timer interrupt to go off here.
Okay, yeah.
Based on the remaining time quantum. So every time we start running something, we look at how much time quantum is left, set up the timer to go off at that time. Other questions? Okay, so something which someone kind of got at, which they're like, wait a moment, doesn't, you know, we just reset A's time quantum every time, you know, up here. We just reset A's time quantum every time, I should go here, every time it finished I.O., so it could run for a lot of time at the highest priority. That's what we're doing because A always has the shortest remaining time until the next, you know, wait period. But that means that there's a way of cheating this scheme. You want to get all the CPU time? Just make sure you do useless I.O. frequently. Also, we're doing priority setting. So if we have a program that doesn't do any I.O., which has, you know, very long CPU bursts, it's always going to be at the lowest priority. If we have other programs that don't have very long CPU bursts, they won't. So in this case, our program A, which has a very long CPU burst, it gets starved. That's just how this works. That's by design. So commonly, real schedulers that have implemented the variant multi-level feedback queues have added things to it to deal with starvation and to deal with programs that are trying to game the scheduler. And there's lots of sort of ideas you could have for like trying to identify interactive things that you want to run in, you know, other ways besides just looking at how long they run, like our multi-level feedback queue. And that sort of, a lot of heuristic schedulers are designed by like looking at these options. Like, can we, you know, keep some better idea of what the program is doing? Can we try to measure, you know, if we're having starvation happen and fix that, and things like that. And can we do this in a way where, like multi-level feedback cues, we have the strength of like not needing to like keep like detailed logs of what the program did and analyze them? Because a nice thing about multi-level feedback cues is even though it has some problems with fairness and some problems about being gameable, it's very low overhead to implement. We're not doing much extra bookkeeping relative to just simple priority scheduling, whereas if we try something more sophisticated, we might have to keep around a lot of extra information that'll make our scheduler slower. So questions about multi-level feedback cues? Okay, so in our remaining minutes, I'm going to talk about Linux's scheduler, which is a different sort. So Linux has a scheduler that is a proportional share scheduler that doesn't use randomization and that has an efficient scheduling decision. So it's not linear time, it's log time, and has a way of favoring interactive programs that's sort of less blunt than the multi-level feedback queue way. And it also adjusts time slices dynamically. So, you know, we kind of had to like set a time quantum some arbitrary way or like try to match the time quantums to the CPU burst. Linux has a different idea of how to do that. And it tries to adjust time slices so we have shorter time slices when there are more things to run. The idea is we're paying more overhead if we have more things to run and, you know, avoiding the overhead when there's only a few things to run. Don't like have unnecessary context switches if there's not much reason to, you know, not many things to switch to. So Linux's scheduler is called the completely fair scheduler. And I said it's proportional share. I'm going to first talk about it just assuming it's equal share, and then we'll add the proportional part later, probably next time. And the sort of key way it works is it tracks this idea called virtual runtime. So rather than doing priorities or ticket counts, we track this notion of virtual runtime. And every time a thread runs, we increment its virtual runtime by how long it ran. And what thread do we schedule? We schedule the one with the lowest virtual runtime. And I said, okay, wait a moment. I guess I'll talk about, briefly allude to how we add proportional share. So if we want to add proportionality, that sharing thing, we'll just, instead of incrementing the virtual runtime by how many seconds it ran for, we'll do how many seconds it ran for times a weight. And if a thread's twice as important, it'll have a weight of like a half. So each time, unit of time it runs counts for half. So it's twice as important. And we're also going to do something about threads that were sleeping or were new. We're going to do some adjustment. We'll talk about what that adjustment is later. But let's think about how this basic scheme works with threads that can always run. So we're tracking this virtual runtime idea. And let's say initially we have threads A, B, and C. Thread A has used 0.5 milliseconds of virtual runtime. Thread B, 1.25. And thread C, 1.4. And we're scheduling with 1 millisecond time quantum. So we run A for 1 millisecond, then A's virtual time is now 1.5. Then we need to figure out what do we run next. We run the thing with the lowest virtual time, which is B. We run B for 1 millisecond, B's time is now 2.25. Now we schedule the thing with lowest virtual time, that's now C. We run C, C has now 2.4. Now what has lowest virtual time, it's A. So we end up implementing, when everything's always runnable, just round robin. Just a funny way of implementing round robin. Where things are going to be different is what if A, B, or C doesn't use the whole millisecond, or does IO, or something like that. So questions about sort of how we get, how this virtual time notion gives us round robin when we just have no weights and do that? Yes? How can we have initial times? The assumption is that A, B, and C were running beforehand. We'll talk about setting initial times a bit later. Yes? Question is, we'll choose the one with the lowest milliseconds? Yes. So I haven't talked about how we set the time when threads start, but the assumption is that these had non-zero initial times because they were running before. But we'll have to do something special when we start a new thread. Yes, and we'll talk about that in a second. Yes?
Is this attached to the multi-level feedback
queue? Question is this attached to the multi-level feedback queue? No, this is a different scheme that happens to accidentally achieve some of the same goals, but it has a very different sort of thing it's optimizing first. So the multi-level feedback queue, you can think of as they're trying to optimize that shortest remaining time first priority first, and then when people deployed it, they added sort of fairness on top of that. Here, what we're gonna do is we're gonna start by doing fairness and then add sort of prioritization for things that are interactive on top of that. Other questions? Okay. So at Steam, we just run the time with the reading time. So if everyone uses the whole quantum, it's just round robin. So what happens if they don't? So let's say we have a thread become runnable. So a thread does some IO, it comes back. What we do is we need to set its virtual time when it comes back. And we could just leave its virtual time unchanged. And what that would mean is that a thread that does some IO for 100 milliseconds now gets 100 milliseconds of virtual time to catch up, where it's going to be ahead of everyone else, because its number is going to remain lower. Now, let's say some thread goes to sleep for a day. Let's say I'm running my web browser, I minimize the window, I come back the next day. If we think of this virtual time scheme, it seems like my web browser is ahead of everything else on the machine in virtual time by 8 hours or something like that. So Linux wants to minimize that effect. So what they do is when a process becomes runnable, a thread I should say becomes runnable, it gets its prior virtual time or a little less than the minimum virtual time of everything that's currently ready. And this is kind of hard to think about what this means, but the sort of intuition is that if you do a little bit of I/O and then come back, you still get your full share of the CPU. That we give you the virtual time you had as if nothing happened. If you're not runnable for a while, we're going to give you some amount of advantage over people who are still running, because we want you to catch up, and we want to give you credit for not using the CPU previously, but we don't want to give you 8 hours of credit. We're gonna give you 100 milliseconds of credit. And in this way, we can favor things that were waiting for IO for a while and have them run more quickly. We're not doing it based on their CPU burst length, we're doing it based on how long were they giving up the CPU to let other people run. But we can do it in a way which is not gonna cause starvation. So let's look at how this works. So let's say we have A that is doing some IO. So A runs for, in this case, half a millisecond, and then it's not ready anymore. It does some very quick IO, talks to something on the network, and then a millisecond later, it's runnable. Or maybe less than a millisecond later, right? It's runnable. And A gets scheduled right away because it still has the lowest virtual time when it comes back. When it's runnable again, has the lowest virtual time, still gets to run. And then it has more virtual time than C. We switch back to C and then back to A, it still has the lowest virtual time. So you see that A kind of got some credit for giving up the CPU to do IO. We didn't not let it use the CPU when it came back. So questions about the sort of prioritizing A as it comes back from some IO operation. Okay. Now let's say we have A, which rather than doing an IO which took a millisecond, let's say it did an IO which took a second. In that case, A is sleeping, it's waiting for IO, then it becomes it's still sleeping. We have B and C running, and let's say A becomes runnable. What we could do is we could let A continue running with that same virtual time, but that would be really annoying because then A would get to run for 0.8 seconds without letting B and C run. So rather than doing that, what Linux does is they say, we're going to let A run an extra millisecond. So we're going to set its virtual time to be a millisecond less than anything else that's running, that's ready, I should say. So in this case, we set, rather than giving it 1.5 milliseconds virtual time, we set it to 1 minus B's virtual time. So we make sure it gets an extra millisecond to run for coming back from its IO. So this means that if A does lots of I/O, it gets to run right away, but it doesn't get to run, you know, hog the CPU after it comes back in an I/O. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today. Next time we'll finish up talking about the completely fair scheduler, and we'll start talking about threads.